Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour, and here it is, a brand new week on the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room. I'm trying to, not having just a whole heck of a lot of success at the moment, but trying just the same. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. Pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and, well, you'll be right there in the midst of the real-time multimedia extravaganza that takes place during the 3 hours of this program every evening. Yes, indeed. Also, at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, the ever-present, incredibly necessary Contribute tab. That's where you go if you want to help us keep this little uncommercial, non-commercial, non-profit-driven enterprise, exercise, effort on the air. And I am proud to say that thanks to our buddy Tom in the Bay Area, we have a habit back. Well, I'm certainly off to a rousing start, aren't I? We have. Maybe I should just repress the button and start all over again. Oh, I'm recording this time. That's a good thing. I managed to screw up Friday and missed about half the program because of the technical glitches that kind of get your head sideways. But anyway, thanks to our buddy Tom in the Bay Area, we have a Have Half a Show on Me challenge on the table this evening to help take care of fundraising for the evening. And thank you very kindly to Tom for that. So there is a $100 matching challenge on the table that will double your money if, in fact, we can raise $100 this evening. And that would be just great. It's what keeps us on the air, plain and simple. And there are a boatload of bills to pay this week. It seems there always are. This week it's fun stuff like internet and telephony bills, and the fun folks with the ancient coal-fired mid-20th century rickety, but it's time to pay the power bill. Yeah. Oh, well. So we got that. But lots of bills are due. Those are the two on top, and then there's others. But we've got a matching challenge on the table, and the first $100 that comes in gets doubled, courtesy of Tom in the Bay Area via his Have Half a Show on Me challenge. Thank you, Tom, and hopefully thank you to everyone who responds to it. Ah, good. Well, thank you, Tim. Tim from L.A. letting me know that at the moment, he and Anatole and Jeremy in Vermont and Jug of Punch and Lottie and Sparky are all there in the room. Goody. So that gets the program started. Now, it is Monday. It is the 20th day of July, 2015. This program is, in fact, live. Oh, God. A problem was encountered while trying to load this chat room. Please contact the site administrator for help resolving this problem. Oh, for Pete's sake. I didn't take the update yet. that must be the problem. Okay. We'll get the update and watch everything go to hell. Yeah, maybe I'll be there. Maybe I won't. Run the little bastard. Okay. Anyway, it is, and maybe this is a fitting start to it, it's Moran Monday on the Horn. And we have, yes, we've got an entire bushel basket full of the little bastards. And we will be dealing with them in short order. Oh, by the way, yes, it is also the 20th of the month here. Oh, hi. Thank you, Tim. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Yeah, Tim says, oh, one more thing. Who are you? See, that's the degree to which this is not an ego-driven program. I forget to say who I am. Yeah, but I am. This is encouraging. Randy says, I took the Java update on my Mac, and it did go to hell. Nice. But thank you to Robert in Australia. He just made the 20th of the month even better. Robert says, it's time for the 20th of the month down under miserable exchange rate challenge. And doesn't the exchange rate suck at the moment? I'm going to send $50 Australian, as that's what I plan for each month. But that means, thanks to the magic of international money exchange rates, that the Horn will only get about 36 U.S. dollars. So if people would like to match my challenge with 50 in U.S. dollars, not 36, I'd be most happy. So there we go. That's perfect. With that, we can knock down today, knock out the little bit that was left over from Friday, and go from there. So thank you, Robert. Thank you very, very kindly. So there's 136, we'll call it 150, because the intent is what matters. There's 150 matching dollars on the table to that will double your money if people will only come forward with it. And, you know, that makes things, like I said, ever so much better. And on top of that, well, this is very good. On top of that, another $50 challenge. So that's anonymously tendered. So that makes 200. That's 200 bucks if there are people, 10 people at 20, 20 people at 10, one person at 200, it matters not. But those challenges are on the table. And if others come forward, then boom, money doubled. And yes, Marty, Mondays are always a bumper crop around here, unfortunately. Let me see, what's uninstall older versions? Okay. We can do that too. Now, let's see. I got a bunch of them. Morans, that is. Rich profusion, as it were. And where to begin? Where to begin? Where to begin? Because the mouth walkers and knuckle breathers were mouth walking and knuckle breathing all over the place this weekend. So that means, if you haven't seen it, run over to Raw Story. That's where it came from for me. Run over to Raw Story and find the headline, Race to the Bottom, I think the word race was used intentionally. Race to the bottom. These two photos illustrate perfectly how ugly and pathetic white supremacists are. This is a radio program, so it presents certain challenges in terms of visual material, so all I can do is suggest that you go there and you look. I, honest to God, am saving this photo. It is a picture of the fine, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered people who showed up in defense of the Confederate flag this past Saturday in Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. But I get ahead of myself. I do. There are certain things that we do to observe. There are certain obsequies involved with the observation of Moran Monday, and we need to attend to them.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Step right up, step right up. That's right. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Come away from the goldfish game. Hurry on over before you actually win an iguana over there with the ping pong balls. Get right over here to the Moran Monday tent. That's right, friends and neighbors. You will not believe your ears. Behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas reside Morans of all variety. Right-wing Morans such as will shock your very ears right off the sides of your head. We have Bircher Morans, Birther Morans, Deather Morans, Ninther Morans, Deather Morans, Tenther Morans, Booger-Eaten Morans, Libertarian Morans, Republican Morans, one and all. Yes, indeed, you can't tell the program without a Moran. You can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. Oh, my goodness gracious. Please be advised that when you enter the Moran Monday tent, you should keep a close hold upon purses, wallets, children, small animals, and European messenger bags, as being right-wingers, the Morans can get grabby. Head for the hills or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. What do I mean by that? Well, like I said, over at Raw Story, the photograph is contained in a piece headlined "Race to the Bottom." These two photos illustrate perfectly how ugly and pathetic white supremacists are. I don't know how pathetic it makes them, but goddamn, they ugly. To everybody out there. Anyone out there who wants to fly that flag, these are your people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Golly Moses. The skinny little guy who could maybe be played by Steve Buscemi in the movie, with his arm all inked up and wearing his Klan shirt with his Klan cross on it, and another shirtless booger eater, and they've all got their mouths open, and they holding up some sort of finger symbol. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was some sort of Southern pride thing. That's he's just flipping somebody the bird. Oh, but they were there in Charleston, Columbia, South Carolina. Oh, Eric Bjorn is going to be so mad at me. They were there in Columbia, South Carolina. Columbia, South Carolina on Saturday in all their rich Southern heritage glory. I don't know. I'm looking at these folks, and I'm thinking old Mars Bobby Lee ain't going to be inviting them to the cotillion. And they are certainly never going to show up at the barbecue down at 12 Oaks. Once y'all have seen it, and let me know by email, because it doesn't look like I'm ever getting into the chat room. Notify me by email as to whom you think is the most delightful member of that photo montage. I have my own opinion. I'll keep it to myself. The article is by Tom Bagioni, otherwise known as T-Bog. And he writes, Saturday afternoon in South Carolina, white supremacists, KKK members, neo-Nazis, Confederate treason sympathizers, and other white people known as the Republican base or potential Donald Trump vice presidential candidates showed up to wave the Confederate flag and just be their normal badass racist selves. He notes it went about as well as secession did beginning back in 1860. And then the photos. And in that first paragraph, there's a moment of truth. And part of this Moran Monday nominating process comes to us via our dear friend Carol Baker, who noted over the weekend that after the outrage. And it was a pretty outrageous statement. After the outrage that was caused by Donald Trump saying that John McCain was no war hero because he got captured. Well, all and sundry of the Republican presidential hopefuls, from Piyush Jindal to Scott Walker to Jeb Bush, et cetera, ad nauseum, all had to come out and try to publicly shame Donald Trump, which, by the way, is an exercise in futility, because you cannot shame someone who has none of it. Up in Canada, Ron noting, "Yep, they be ugly." Talking about the people in the photograph there at Raw Story. Your eye or your keen eye for the finer details is still there. Still keen. I'm not feeling so keen. But anyway, what was fascinating out of the kerfuffle arising out of Trump's remarks about John McCain, and of course John McCain went on Squint and the Meat Puppet this morning to proclaim that he didn't want an apology from Donald Trump, but that he had certainly insulted lots and lots of our wounded warriors. And this, of course, is this is something many people will recognize. It's the same. It falls under the same general category heading as when Mama looks at you and you're a little kid and says, "Well, honey, I'm not mad at you. Mama's disappointed." And then the sniffle and the one little tear out of the corner of the eye, and you know you done made Mama cry. And then you understand that you are lower than whale shit at the bottom of the ocean. Mm-hmm. This is that. And meanwhile, Trump tried to bluster his way through a phone call to the Today Show. I didn't actually watch any of this. I just read accounts of it, okay? I don't think I'd be here if I'd actually sat through any of it. I'd still be screaming and tearing at my clothing. Why? Because the morons in the for-profit media have been suckered yet again. One, they were suckered insofar as their outrage machine certainly got primed up to a fever pitch and turned up to 11. While at the same time, they managed to forget, and this was the part that Carol pointed out, they managed to forget a little something that went down in the summer of 2004. That was back when the military service of John Kerry was being called into question as a matter of policy by the GOP, the Republican Party. It wasn't just one lone loudmouth. No, no, no. It was an orchestrated campaign with lots of money called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And there's an iconic photograph out there of a sort of corpulent, middle-aged lady. She was not yet, no one was yet wearing tea bags because that one had not yet entered our White House. But I seem to recall she had on some sort of headgear, but prominently displayed upon the side of her face was a Band-Aid, what in former years was referred to as a flesh-colored Band-Aid, although that color of Band-Aid is not the same color as anybody's flesh. I think it was a secret pigment shipped in from Norblap 12. Maybe it matches them. But it's a Band-Aid on her face. Man, I bet it hurt like hell when all the hair came out when she pulled it off. Never mind. But on that Band-Aid was drawn, and lots of people in the convention hall, dare I say thousands, were wearing them. A Band-Aid with a purple heart, sharpied onto it. Because, see, back in 2004, the going thinking was that John Kerry had not deserved his Purple Heart. The Republican Party felt entirely confident and comfortable in questioning the military service, and not just military service in Vietnam, but military service for which he did not have to be conscripted, for which he did not wait to be conscripted, but for which he volunteered, John Kerry. Yeah, in 2004, the Republican Party was absolutely at their leisure and at ease in declaring who and was not a military hero. But now, today, some Republicans and all of the presidential candidates except Donald Trump are outraged, I tell you, outraged that Donald Trump would say that John McCain wasn't a hero because he got shot down over Vietnam. Outraged. And it was a freshman congressman from South Florida, and I can't remember his name right off the bat, who had argued earlier in the week that in point of fact, Donald Trump was a Democratic plot, and aren't those Democrats just really, really inscrutable, if this is true, which it isn't. We're not clever enough to come up with something like this. But that it was a Democratic plot to make Republicans look bad, Donald Trump's candidacy. As if he was so hard up for cash. That he needed somebody to maybe, you know, offer him a little bit of scratch to go and be a stealth candidate to make Republicans look bad. I thought it was silly then. It's silly. I didn't even feature it on the program. But no, I became convinced after this kerfuffle over the weekend that in fact, Donald Trump may be a stealth candidate, but he is a stealth candidate of the RNC's own creation Because every time, when, for instance, I mean, let's just think about this. I mean, this doesn't require any aluminum foil headgear or anything. No one's talking to me through my flashlight, nor the heel of my shoe. Well, let's just think about this. Prior to Donald Trump, and going all the way back to the earliest days of Marco Rubio's, who's a presidential candidate now, remember? Earliest days of Marco Rubio's presence in the Senate of the United States. Well, Senator Rubio, wet behind the ears and green as grass though he may be, said we got to do something. As a Republican, he said we got to do something about immigration, and sort of hinted at being a little humane about it. Not real humane. I mean, he is after all a Republican. And wait, we can go back even further in time to the 2012 presidential contest, when Rick Perry pretty much took himself out of the running, apart from, you know, being Rick Perry, and there's nobody ever going to elect Rick Perry president, but took himself out of the running by, again, saying that maybe some sort of nuance was called for in dealing with the immigration situation in the United States. And, of course, the Republican base went, yeah, lost whatever it was that passes for minds in the, among those thin gray settlings that slosh around between their ears where their brains ought to be, and provide some sort of, I don't know, movement insulation for their great big lizard brain amygdalae. And so from that day to this, and up until Trump said something about Mexicans, the Republicans were four square again them, and thoroughly convinced that from the Rio Grande southward, it's all Mexico. No, I mean, no Costa Rica, no Guatemala, no Honduras, no Panama, Nicaragua, no Colombia, nothing. It's all just Mexicans. It's all Mexicans. And then Trump said that Mexicans are coming to America and raping our women's. And all the Republicans go, oh, how dare he? Oh, my goodness. Oh, no. And thereby got to look sane and humane. Well, see, he's obviously a serious candidate because he said that Donald Trump is a poopy head. And then this. And all these darn fools get to run out there and act like they give a rat's rear end about people in the military, when in fact all any Republican ever wants to do is send them off to kill them and then ignore them if they don't get killed and come back wounded or shattered or damaged in some way. Yeah. It's perfect. It's a perfect dodge. And naturally, the for-profit media ate it right out of Rince Priebus' scaly little hand. So I just sat there watching it all unfold and thinking, this couldn't be more obvious if they had a sign up that said, this way to the egress. Yeah. So we've got that. A nomination of the for-profit media and anyone who is believing the narrative as it is being presented. False flag! False flag. Mm-hmm. That's one. And then there's another one. And I, Oh, okay. I had no idea. The Republican National Committee has put out a statement on Donald Trump. They say it's just awful. It's just terrible that anybody would ever disparage any veteran. And yet, at the same time, this is the same Republican Party that is hooting for a firing squad for Bo Bergdahl. Remember him?
I do, yeah.
So, there's that. We'll tuck it away. Your thoughts, of course, are always welcome, either by phone or by email or by Facebook or by Twitter. I trust you know how to use any and all to reach me. And no, I'm not in the chat room. So, there you go. Maybe later. Who knows? But there's that. And then this. Nobody here likes David Brooks. We find him at best comical and at worst revolting. But he did, I mean, he outdid himself with a, it wasn't really a review, but it was just a response. It was a whitesplain is what it was, of Ta-Nehisi Coates's new book, which is couched in the terms of a letter to his son about what it means to be black in America. At the outset, David Brooks gives himself some good advice and then promptly ignores it, because he says maybe the right thing to do is simply to read it, listen, and say nothing. But he couldn't do that. No, David Brooks had to go on about it. Yeah, because he doesn't like Mr. Coates' tone. You know, his tone. And he says that Mr. Coates, he overlooks that for the fact that for every Jefferson Davis, there's an Abraham Lincoln. He really did. He dragged out the old "but Lincoln freed the slaves" argument. And he did everything but say, "I have a black friend who tells me blah blah." I imagine that was probably blue penciled in the editing process. And he, especially, didn't like the fact that he perceived Mr. Coates to be suggesting that the American dream is flim-flam. David Brooks' words, flim-flam. Is flim-flam one word or two? Or is there a hyphen? I don't know. David Brooks, by the way, has the self-awareness of Jell-O. And that may be a bit too generous. But David Brooks actually presumed to lecture Mr. Coates on what was wrong with his critique of the American dream. The New York Times published it. God knows why, but then again, they published Maureen Dowd. And I mean, these people, alongside Thomas Friedman, are the New York Times idea of what passes for public intellectuals in Merca. God knows why. David Brooks is a public intellectual. Just ask him; he'll tell you. I mean, this is a guy who taught a class at Yale in humility, for God's sakes. But it astonishes me. Is it in the contract? I don't know. Where if you get to be a columnist with the New York Times, there's just something in the contract that says there will be no editorial process whatsoever. No editor will look over my work. No editor will say whether or not it goes in the paper. It just does. Because I can't imagine the editor at the busted knuckle moral volcano and battle cry of freedom letting this thing in to print. It was that astonishingly awful. It is strikingly so. Let's see. Let me. The last year has been an education for white people. Well, thanks, Dave. I'm so glad you could speak for me. There has been a depth, power, and richness. A richness, mind you. Whew, really? To the African-American conversation about Ferguson, Baltimore, Charleston, and the other killings that has been humbling and instructive. I'd like to have caught David Brooks in that humble moment, wouldn't you? I don't think science has instruments that can measure an interval of time as tiny as one of David Brooks being humble. Because there may have been a moment, but it's by God passed, and it's time to explain Mr. Coates' problems to him. Your new book, Mr. Coates, Between the World and Me, is a great and searing contribution to this public education. It is a mind-altering account of the black male experience. Every conscientious American should read it. So we've gotten that out of the way. There is a pervasive physicality to your memoir, the elemental vulnerability of living in a black body in America. Outside African-American nightclubs, you write, black people controlled nothing, least of all the fate of their bodies, which could be commandeered by the police, which could be erased by the guns, which were so profligate, which could be raped, beaten, jailed. Written as a letter to your son, you talk about the effects of pervasive fear. When I was your age, the only people I knew were black, and all of them were powerfully, adamantly, dangerously afraid. But the disturbing challenge of your book is your rejection of the American dream.
Is that David Brooksism for being uppity?
How dare you? You challenge the American dream. You don't just challenge it, you reject the American dream. It's the American dream, damn it!
And then, in a moment of sublime white-splaining, my ancestors chose to come here. For them, America was the antidote to the crushing restrictiveness of European life, to the pogroms. For them, the American dream was an uplifting spiritual creed that offered dignity, the chance to rise.
Are you running?
Your ancestors came in chains. In your book, the dream of the comfortable suburban life is a fairy tale. For you, slavery is the original American sin, from which there is no redemption. Mind you, for Mr. Coates, it's the sin. Not for anybody else, just him. Certainly not for David Brooks. I mean, David Brooks can say,
Really? We have an original? Haven't we been forgiven?
Ron and Raleigh asking, why is it, Bob, that whenever I always think of Thurston Howell III when I read or see that pudgy pillock, David Brooks? Well, maybe it's because I'm using the voice. Because this is just how I think of David Brooks.
Now bring me another serving of the lobster thermidor, would you?
Yes, thank you. And I must say, this Pui Fusé is magnificent. I thought our last bottle was a bit plebeian, didn't you, darling, Monty? For you, slavery is the original American sin from which there is no redemption. America is Egypt without the possibility of the Exodus. African-American men are caught in a crushing logic determined by the past from which there is no escape.
Notice that that is all David Brooks channeling Ta-Nehisi Coates. Because, of course, it needs to be white-splained.
You write to your son, here is what I would like for you to know. In America, it is traditional to destroy the black body. It is heritage. The innocent world of the dream is actually built on the broken bodies of those kept down below.
And it's true. Now, everyone has their... almost everyone. Not everyone. Everyone of origin anywhere but here has their immigrant experience, their immigrant story. Some older, some newer. For David Brooks, David Brooks tries to elicit sympathy by referencing the pogroms. But it matters not whether one came from Russia, Estonia, Lithuania, Italy, Germany, Ireland, Scotland, England. It matters not whence, Spain, Portugal, Greece, and yes, China, the Philippines, Japan. Everyone who came here from somewhere else stepped, their first step onto this continent was onto crushed bones. And no matter what kind of racism or prejudice or bias any given ethnic group coming to this continent has, they were not brought here against their will, and they did not have a genocide perpetrated upon them by the colonizers.
David Brooks continues, if there were no black bodies to oppress, the affluent dreamers would have to determine how to build their suburbs on something other than human bones, how to angle their jails toward something other than a human stockyard, how to erect a democracy independent of cannibalism. And then, in what is probably the ultimate expression of white-splaining, he says, your definition of white is complicated.
I don't think it's that complicated.
Look in mirror, not white. Don't look like me, white. But you're right, white America is a syndicate arrayed to protect its exclusive power to dominate and control our bodies. Sometimes this power is direct, lynching, and sometimes it is insidious, redlining.
Okay, so this is a restatement. Your definition of white is complicated begins that paragraph, and he says, but you write. And the use of the word but is disjunctive to your definition of white is complicated. And by the way, editorial grammar moment. Your definition of white is complicated. Period. Okay, that's a proper sentence. But you write white America is a syndicate. No editors. But she... My ninth grade English teacher would have docked me a letter grade for starting a sentence that way. I suppose, however, that one may get away with it when one is a genuine, no-kidding, honest-to-goodness New York Times op-ed columnist wordsmith. Ninth grade English would get you an F. But then comes the smear. And by that, he says, in what is bound to be the most quoted passage from the book, you write that you watched the smoldering towers of 9/11 with a cold heart. A cold heart.
He don't love America.
At the time, you felt the police and firefighters who died were, quote, were menaces of nature. They were the fire, the comet, the storm, which could, with no justification, shatter my body. And then, just in case anybody is misunderstanding David Brooks, you obviously do not mean that literally today. Sometimes in your phrasing, you seem determined to be misunderstood.
Really? He grammar policed him? In a column whose grammar wouldn't pass muster in ninth grade, he is going to question. Wow, I wonder if he would do this to a book by Thomas Friedman. Or dare I say it, a book by Ted Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, anointed future King of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz. Wonder if he'd do it to Jeb Bush.
Sometimes in your phrasing you seem determined to be misunderstood. Why can't you write a little whiter? Maybe it's all of that hip-hop you've been listening to. Goodness me. That Grandmaster Flash fellow. That's the performing artist's name, isn't it? Or that rapper who's, what was his, a backpack. Backpack? Two-pack. Or that 50 Cent fellow. You're illustrating the perspective born of the rage, quote, that burned in me then, animates me now, and will likely leave me on fire for the rest of my days. Close quote. I read all this like a slap and a revelation.
Well, good, Dave, because you know that's what he was doing. He was writing a book to wake you up, Dave Brooks. You public intellectual, you.
I suppose the first obligation is to sit with it, to make sure the testimony is respected and sinks in.
Notice he supposes that. He's not certain of it. The jury is still out, but he supposes. It might be that he should just shut up and take it in and try not to judge it before he has simply experienced the written word. But I have to ask, because after all, David Brooks is a public intellectual, goddammit. Am I displaying my privilege if I disagree?
Well, yeah.
Every time you touch a keyboard and it gets published in the New York Times, you're displaying your privilege, David Brooks. But damn, that hasn't slowed you down before, and it didn't slow you down on this one.
Is my job just to respect your experience and accept your conclusions? Does a white person have standing to respond, oh my God, he's going to get up on the cross? Astonishing. I think our buddy Steve in New York has nailed it. Oh, Mr. Coates, why can't you talk like that other Negro chap, Colin Powell? He talks very well. He likes the American dream. Does a white person have standing to respond?
Well, I think white, you know, Dave, I think white people have been responding all along. A lot of times they respond in the dark, on horseback, a century ago, wearing sheets and pillowcases. That was a white response.
But then this. Oh, this. If I do have standing, the idea of using a legal term like standing is hilarious insofar as so much of the legal system has been bent double to make sure that people of color receive no justice in this country. The other night we were talking about how on Ida B. Wells' birthday, I was talking about how Ida B. Wells actually sued a Tennessee railroad company for not providing her the first-class prepaid train ticket seat that she had purchased. And she won at the trial court level, but the appeals court said, oh, no, no, we've found an exception here. No Negroes are allowed to win legal cases. Reversed and remanded. That. Or simply gunning down a young black man almost a year ago now in the street and leaving his body laying in the street like a rabid dog that had been shot in the August heat. If I do have standing, I find the causation. He finds because he's the fucking king, right? The causation between the legacy of lynching and some guy's decision to commit a crime inadequate to the complexity of most individual choices. Yeah, right. Because David Brooks just can't understand that in an existence that is exactly that, an existence and not a life. Where education has been scant, if at all, where opportunity is non-existent, well, read Mr. Coates' book, at the risk of me being as guilty of white-splaining as David Brooks. But the legacy of lynching and some guy's decision to commit a crime, well, it's inadequate to the complexity of most individual choices. Now, I will Brooksplain and say that what that means is that he's saying not every criminal person of color is thinking about lynching before he... No. I think you distort American history. Yeah. This country, like each person in it, is a mixture of glory and shame.
Really? David Brooks is a mixture? David Brooks just said he's a mixture of glory and shame. Where's the shame part, Dave? Because, nobody's ever seen you display any of it.
Now, I will concede the point of his next column says, my goodness gracious, am I ashamed of that last column. Why did the editor ever let it get onto the page? But that ain't going to happen now, is it? There's a Lincoln for every Jefferson Davis. Is there? Who was the counterpart to John Wilkes Booth, Dave? Who held the hangman's noose for Bobby Lee after he had held it for John Brown? Hint, no one. And there's a Harlem Children's Zone for every KKK. Did he? Yes, he did just draw a parallel. Oh, my God. And usually vastly more than one. Yeah, because Dave knows. Violence is embedded in America, but it is not close to the totality of America. There's plenty of people we could ask about that totality. I saw the mother of the sailor from the Chattanooga shooting who died over the weekend, and the mother came to the strip mall there to pay her respects. Sweet Jesus, there were a bunch of American flags around, but I couldn't help noticing, and smack dab in the middle of it all, there was one of those goddamn filthy Confederate treason rags. And they just let it stay there. Heritage. I did one of those not a double take, but a W.C. Fields spit out the nanny goat's milk triple take. When I saw it, and someone from the for-profit media, of course, stuck their camera in this grieving woman's face to say what, and she just said he died doing what he wanted to do. And that part I actually did see. And just shook my head. Once again, deeply challenged to figure out how that was in any way whatsoever newsworthy. Violence is embedded in America. We could do a master class on that, couldn't we? Turns out Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz had struggled with depression all of his life. This will, of course, provide fodder for the NRA to see, guns don't kill people, depressed people kill people. But it, of course, also raises the issue of how does one go about getting a firearm when one is chronically depressed? Clinically depressed. And takes us back to the argument that I've made before that even with the police, and we don't seem to be having that much success with them, there is at least a degree of psychological profiling before we turn them loose with a powerful automobile and all kinds of different weapons that they can then use on the general populace that they deem to be worthy of having it used upon. And not even that. And going actually in the opposite direction toward open carry. Because armed society is a polite society. Until somebody shoots your face off. Violence is embedded in America, but it is not close to the totality of America. I'm not sure that that isn't a phrase that is freighted with absolute 110% 200-proof bullshit. Violence may very well be the totality of America. Or if not the totality, the norm and not the exception. But here's the one that sent me running into the yard. In your anger at the tone of innocence some people adopt to describe the American dream, comma, the hell is that, the tone of innocence some people adopt to describe the American dream? I don't even know what that means. Is he talking about children reciting fairy tales from the founding?
And George Washington said, "Yes, Father, I did cut down the cherry tree, for I cannot tell a lie."
That? Is that the tone of innocence? If there's a tone of innocence that some people use to describe the American dream, that tone of innocence is most often made by people who have it made inside the American dream. Because I have yet to hear the American dream described in innocent tones, again with the tone. I don't like your tone. Nobody who really knows what's going on here talks about the American dream in an innocent tone. Go west, young man! Horatio Alger, is that it? That innocent tone can only be accomplished by forgetting the entirety of the real history of this nation. Because one cannot have an innocent tone about the United States of America and the American dream if one understands that this entire nation is like a, I don't know, it's like a raft that floats on an ocean of blood. And just because you've got a nice stateroom on the boat doesn't make the ocean of blood any less bloody. But David Brooks has vast spaces for entertaining. That's the way they describe the home that he bought. Lavish, not vast, lavish. Lavish spaces for entertaining, and probably could... Shit. David Brooks would be horrified by even 1 minute among the people whose tone he doesn't like. You know who manifests an innocent tone about the American dream? W. Bush. "We got a woman here who works three jobs. That's uniquely American." You know who manifests an innocent tone about the American dream? Willard Romney. "There are 47% of Americans out there who are just dependent on the government, and we've got to overcome them. Because we're job creators." You know who talks it with an innocent tone about the American dream? White men. Donald Trump talks with an innocent tone, although it is also ignorant as hell, brash, stupid, and annoying. "I'm Donald Trump. I got huge wealth. 'Cause America. I'm a billionaire. 'Cause the American dream." Mostly the people who talk with innocent tones about the American dream are people who, well, who have no idea of work. Donald Trump's never worked a day in his godforsaken life. And neither have the Bushes or the Romneys. Oh, hell no. And bless his little heart, John McCain has been on the public teat since he got home from Vietnam. And that's just a fact. Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, the zombie-eyed granny starver, one of the few jobs he ever held was driving the goddamned Oscar Mayer Wienermobile before he got his front feet in the trough. Brand new first-generation immigrants to this country will talk about the American dream, and they'll generally talk about it in their native language, which, you know, people like David Brooks wish they would just the hell learn to speak English already. But there are no innocent tones in that. They know that the American dream means that they're going to work 16, 18, 19-hour days for the rest of their life in hopes that their children will get an education and have it a little bit better than they did. American dream, my ass. In your anger at the tone of innocence some people adopt to describe the American dream, you reject the dream itself as flim-flam, but a dream sullied is not a lie. Now, what David Brooks is trying to do there, and he does it, although I hate to admit it, somewhat artfully, is to obliquely reference a poem by Langston Hughes. A dream sullied is not a lie. So you see, that's all that lynching did, was it sullied the American dream. It besmirched something that made David Brooks rich. But a dream sullied is not a lie. To anybody with kind of a literary education, that immediately calls forth Langston Hughes. And by dredging up Langston Hughes, David Brooks is kind of, I know what it's like to be a Negro because I've read Langston Hughes when I was going to school in the Ivy League. Because Langston Hughes wrote, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode?" And see, in that little poem, A Dream Deferred, you know, that's nearly a century ago, if not more. And that's Langston Hughes asking the same questions that Mr. Coates is asking in 2015, and the amount of progress that's been made in that amount of time is, frankly, something best measured with a microscope.
Oh, but what about Brown versus Board of Education and ending segregation? What about lunch counters and civil rights? That's all shit that was supposed to have been taken care of before. That wasn't progress. That was an attempt to return to an actual status normal. And it still didn't work out.
The American dream of equal opportunity, social mobility, and ever more perfect democracy cherishes the future more than the past.
That's because it can't look at the past. If it looks at the past, it sees nothing but a lie. Because that's all it's ever been. George Carlin said they call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
The American dream abandons old wrongs and transcends old sins for the sake of a better tomorrow. Please, Mr. Coates, can't you please stop talking about how painful it is for you to be black so we can have a better tomorrow for the sake of a better tomorrow?
Jesus!
This dream is a secular faith that has unified people across every known divide.
Bullshit, he said to Robin, and he turned and walked away. There's a big difference in American dreams. I guess, in communities of color, there's an American dream, and that American dream is not to get killed the next day.
On the other hand, Mr. Brooks's American dream is to see his stock portfolio go up by at least 2%. My goodness, my stars and garters.
The one thing, mercifully, he didn't say in here was, but Dr. King. I imagine that got knocked down on the edit.
And then, because he wants to make sure that he plays the martyr card on the way out the door, maybe you will find my reactions irksome. Maybe the right white response is just silence for a change. In any case, you've filled my ears unforgettably.
Because it's all about David Brooks. It's all about David Brooks' privilege to have his ears filled.
And maybe the right white response is just silence for a change. I'm going to get my hands on this book. And I'm going to read it and maybe hope to understand it a little better, but I don't think I'm going to be writing any columns about it or any blog posts or... No. Maybe I'll pass it to my children. Because, see, it's important for me to note that here in almost level West by Cole, Virginia, Stan, and Greater Appalachistan, for that matter, we know next to nothing about the black experience. I know a little bit more because of my raisin. But to drive down to the Rippy Mart here, 2 miles away, I can do that every day for the next 2 weeks, and I might see a person of color once, maybe twice. And that's one. So people here don't understand. Now, if you were to tap them on the shoulder and say, "Pardon me, are you a racist?" Why, heavens no. I don't have anything against those people. See? Oh, but, well, never mind. A lot of learning worth doing. David Brooks, however, is not what I would call advancing the cause. That was written as cover for any well-to-do white folks who might be made uncomfortable reading it. Or maybe they'll see him on TV. And that would, it might put them off their shrimp cocktails. Because David Brooks doesn't write for the hoi polloi. He doesn't write for the middle class, whatever is left of it, and he certainly doesn't write for people of color. He is an apologist
for a sort of, vestigial Eisenhowerish republicanism, and the occasional person who, like him, thought the Iraq War was a good idea, and then, maybe I was wrong. He is an absolute millstone around the neck of the New York Times. And that's probably not a very good image, is it? He doesn't write for poor people. He's not meant to be read by the elderly. He has nothing to say to women. No. He is an apologist for the 1%. And with a column like that, he makes it plain as the nose on his face. Well, I've over-filibobstered a little bit. And we still have a big bucket full of snakes. I mean, more ends. But I want to send out some thanks. Randy said, I'll take the Aussie challenge, and responded to Robert's 20th of the month up over down under crummy exchange rate challenge. Thank you very kindly. And half of Tom's have half a show on me challenge has been met by Joan. Thank you very kindly, Joan. And that leaves $100 more in challenges remaining that hopefully will be met and will go toward the boatload of this week's bill paying. And we've got, an hour and 42 minutes to do it in. Maybe we can make that happen. Yeah. So, you know what? I'm not going to take a break. I'm going to jump right over to the Skype line where Carol's waiting. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
can you tell?
I can tell. I read David Brooks' column, too. And I'm sitting there the whole time reading that going, you're not speaking for women. You're not speaking for white women. You're not speaking for the white elderly. You're not speaking for the white poors.
You can't speak for people you don't see. You can't speak for people who don't exist in your world.
Right. He has a very small sphere of very privileged white people. And I'm sorry if that book made him uncomfortable. No, I'm not sorry that the book made him uncomfortable. It was designed to make him uncomfortable. And I don't think that the proper response is for white people to just read it and shut up. I think the proper response is for white people to read it and acknowledge it.
Or read it and take it into themselves and comprehend it?
Yeah, absolutely. But
I mean, maybe I was wrong in saying, read it and shut up. But I don't think there's anybody who enjoys even one minuscule iota of white privilege who has any business taking issue with it, because it is very much a perspective-driven book. Even though I have not read it, I know that much.
Exactly.
And there aren't any white folks out there who have the perspective to challenge his.
No.
If your perspective is different, get busy. Write your own.
Exactly. But my perspective, as one of the poors, and one of the women's, and one of the olds, is that it's very easy for me to watch as a couple of years back, the Kansas City School District decided that due to budget cuts, there was just a massive budget shortfall. So they closed half of the schools in the city. half. So whose schools do you suppose they closed?
Oh, I don't hardly have to ask now, do I?
Well, you don't have to ask because they decided that obviously we needed to close the schools in the black neighborhoods because they were falling down because they were the schools that had been neglected all along. And in order to keep them open, they would have had to upgrade and spend money in those schools. Whereas all that money had already gone to the white schools and the middle class schools and the mixed race schools. But the predominantly black schools, those were so neglected already and that it just made sense to them to close those schools. So now we sit and we look at the dropout rate and we don't look at the fact that we've now made it twice as hard for people of color, these children of color, to actually get to school. We don't look at the number of the homeless kids that were at least able to go to school in their own neighborhood who are now completely left out. They don't look at the, you know, now the one thing that these kids had was an opportunity to at least go to school and get an education. And yes, if they were by some miracle able to overcome their circumstances and do very well, then they had a chance to go to college. So now that opportunity has been shut down. They have, there's no jobs in their neighborhood. There's no way for them to get to a job. And so now they're left in hopelessness and poverty. So tell me, what's to dream? What is there for these kids to dream of? Not getting killed by the police. So I suppose
oddly enough, that's a low bar and a high bar at the same time, Carol.
Yeah, I guess it's easier for me because I drive through those neighborhoods on a regular basis, and I see how, you know, the resources in the community don't, you know, in the greater Kansas City metro, these are places that are like a mile or 2 miles from some of the richest, most affluent neighborhoods. And by God, they'll spend money on the Plaza and Brush Creek and Westport and all that, but you know, you can't afford to put police or community cleanup in some of the areas that are just.
Well, I mean, to be fair, they'll do all that once they if somebody decides they want to gentrify those neighborhoods.
Well, and that's coming. That's exactly what's coming. You know, there was a real nice area down there where you could you know, buy a condo and do real well, but all of those buildings have now been bought up by very wealthy investors and venture capitalists, and all of those areas down there are rapidly, you know, getting out of the reach of anybody but the most wealthy people. And that used to be a really cool area down there where really young people and very young people and very old people and very ethnic neighborhoods kind of all came together, and it was very interesting. It made it a very interesting place. And it's not so interesting anymore because it's just very... you know, how many Bloomingdale's and Needless Markup and or Neiman Marcus, sorry.
No, that's okay. I call it the same thing.
And those kind of places and Fourier's and, you know, Jewelers, and these are places that mean nothing, and the most unbelievably expensive top shelf restaurants are down there. And, you know, and this was the neighborhood where I had to go to the Apple store. They had done an update, and all of my aftermarket cords wouldn't work overnight.
Right.
So I had to go down to the Apple store and pay top dollar to get these cords so that I could recharge my iPad. And I'm about a couple of doors down from the Apple store, And there's an obviously mentally ill older black man crouching on the sidewalk holding a Quick Trip cup for donations. And he was just so quiet and so sweet. And I reached into my pocket and pulled out a dollar bill and dropped it in his cup. And I'm telling you, he reached out so fast it almost startled me, grabbed my hand, looked up, looked right at me. And he had the most beautiful face. And he smiled at me. And I just patted him on the shoulder. And about that time, I felt somebody tap me on the other shoulder. And I turn around, and there is a plaza security guard. And this is the Kansas City Country Club Plaza. Someplace for a Midwest area, David Brooks would feel very, very at home.
Right.
And
it would be a safe space.
But he hands me this card. And on this card, it's like, it's designed to scold anybody who reaches out and gives a helping hand to a needy person. And because apparently they can't legally force them to move if they're not breaking the law. So what they do is the security guards go around and they hand out these cards telling you that you're hurting these people more than you're helping them. And that if you really want to help, you should donate money to this
shelter.
To this list of these homeless shelters. So, okay. I was so angry. It was like...
Oh, no, I've gotten that lecture. I never got the card, but I've gotten lectured, Carol.
It essentially said, do not feed the animals.
Well, I got it a little more directly, because, you know, we've spent... We've spent a good bit of time working in Washington, D.C., and you cannot work in Washington, D.C. without running across the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding out by virtue of some side reading I'm doing that ain't nothing new. It's been the nature of Washington D.C. from just about the moment that the city was laid out.
Mm-hmm.
But I've reached in and I recall very specifically because it was in Chinatown, and we were with a group of hillbillies.
Mm-hmm.
And I reached in my pocket and pulled out a $5 bill and gave it to somebody. And it was immediately upbraided by one of my fellow hillbillies.
Really?
Who said, don't you know he's just going to use that to buy booze?
None of my business.
And I said, then he must need a drink. And it's none of my business and none of yours. And yet you're here to try to protect our communities from mountaintop removal, and you're going to tell that guy whose life story you don't even know, that one, you think you know what he's going to use it for, and B, you think you know better, or there's a shitload of coal companies, sister, back home who know better than you do what to do with our communities.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of came unglued that evening.
Well, I think that little pimply-faced mall security guard had wished he had never given me that card. I wanted to rip it up and throw it on the ground, but I knew he'd get me for littering. So I just crumbled it up in my hand, and I got it within a half an inch of his face, and I said, how dare you tell me who I can give a shit about? I said, Sonny, when you get heroin between your legs, and you figure out what life is really all about and what's important and what bullshit this is, you'll figure out that you have fucked with the wrong female. And I just stormed off to my car. I didn't even get what I needed. I just stormed off to my car. And I was so angry. I was sitting there shaking, and I said, and then I uncrumpled that piece of paper, and I decided to do a little bit of research. And I found out something very, very interesting about those homeless shelters that they listed. Well, I went through and I called every single one of them. Three of them didn't answer the phone. So if you actually needed help, you didn't get anybody to unlock a door anyway.
Right.
One of them wasn't even a homeless shelter. It was a Christian home for unwed mothers. And then there was one that was an emergency shelter that would only take single women with children, and they would only take them one at a time. So that basically left you with City Union Mission and one other place. And City Union Mission has a very interesting website where they brag that they provide services to over 800 people a week. Well, I drilled down on that one. And if you go to City Union Mission and someone prays for you, that's considered a service, and they put a little chalk mark up there.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah, prayers are services. Essentially, in the greater, well, basically, within the city limits of Kansas City, there are somewhere around 3,000 homeless people. There are fewer than 300 beds a night.
Must make those Midwestern winters interesting.
Exactly. And it was cold outside, too. And there's a reason why mentally ill people don't go to homeless shelters. I mean, it's complicated, but they don't go there. And it just galls me to think that these people of privilege would sit
well,
there.
But see that those people, those organizations on that list, you know, they need those donor dollars, Carol. Because they've got every one of them's got an executive director who's making no less than $60,000 a year.
I know, but I guess I just look at those people as people.
Guess what? So did the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi that those people profess to worship. When Jesus was feeding the multitudes. You know, he didn't say, listen, we're going to need a statement of income from you first. And he didn't say the people who spent their last shekel on wine can't have any bread and fish today.
And he didn't make them pee in a cup before he'd help them.
Right. Jack in Shreveport points out and says, so it sounds like the security guard was nearby scoping out the scene just waiting to pounce.
Oh, he was. He was stalking homeless people. Because God knows there isn't any crime down there. Because they keep all the undesirables out.
Meanwhile, Steve up in New York says, ask these questions. Which neighborhoods do you think the lottery tickets or payday lending or off-track betting or McDonald's or the poor quality grocery stores are in? Anywhere in America, Steve's right, you can gauge the relative affluence or lack thereof of a community just by Dollar General, mm-hmm. Family Dollar,
mm-hmm.
Dollar Tree,
mm-hmm.
McDonald's, liquor stores, and in states that allow it, payday lending.
Mine.
Cash for car titles.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there. And you never find them in your Westports.
You never find them in your Westports.
And they're not up there. They're not up there by at Crippled Fawn Estates either.
No.
No, they are in. That word came into common usage a few years ago, and I had to go somewhere else to learn what it meant. But food deserts.
We have them all over here.
No grocery stores.
We have them all over here.
And now we're learning about them here, Carol, because grocery stores are packing up and leaving town down in the communities that have been ravaged by mountaintop removal.
There were three grocery stores in Hooterville when I moved here. There's one. And that one grocery store is having financial difficulty, and when you go in there, probably about more than 50% of the shelves are empty because they have to pay for the groceries up front.
Right. Our grocery store here used to be a Foodland.
Mm-hmm.
It is now a Wiggling Pig, and they're hanging on for dear life.
Mm-hmm.
And there is one, and this tells This isn't because, for instance, we've had an influx of Asians in our little community here. No. There is an entire aisle, and I've referenced it before, an entire aisle of nothing but ramen noodles.
Yeah.
And there's the four for a dollar kind,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the fancy stuff that costs more than a dollar a cup.
Ooh.
Because it's got the flavor boost packet in it.
Doggy.
And, they've still got the best meat counter in 50 miles.
We had the best meat counter at the Thriftway, and they closed that store. That you could get the best damn meat cuts there, and for the best prices. And when that big store came to town, the other two closed, and now we're down to one, which I now call a half a grocery store.
Well, and in this case, the meat counter even has been a chunk of it has been taken up by the five for 20 section.
So
and,
now,
and these are part, you know, parts is parts chicken nuggets.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Some badass bologna.
Yes.
We've
got that too.
Stuff that you can greasy things that you can microwave. If you're paying attention, you can see the changes. But you know, to back up to the whole business with David Brooks, you know, the way I responded to it, and I was just responding to him saying that, you know, the worst thing is that you dismiss the American dream as flim flam. And I wasn't sure, but I didn't do it out of any ill intent, Carol. But I started thinking about the people in my history who, you know, they didn't know it. They came to know it, but they were taught it. They were taught that the American dream was flim flam. Mm-hmm. And I started, and Appalachia is a laboratory for how much flim flam you can get people to buy. This is an entire region, and you know, I'd like to think that there would be the possibility of an intersectional dialogue about that.
There is.
But I don't know, and I'm gonna move into a separate topic here if you've got time for it.
Sure.
Because I'm not comfortable with it. I'm desperately afraid, and I'm just being candid here, because I am white. Okay, I mean I'm the guy who burns under the refrigerator bulb. Okay.
Well, I'm.
And I'm shiny with my privilege, and I know it.
I'm just one shade darker than you are.
So, I think if we're going to talk about David Brooks, and that odious piece of crap that he put in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about what Mr. Coates, and I say Mr. Coates because I don't know if it's Ta-Nehisi, Ta-Nehisi. I don't know. And I'm sorry.
I don't know either.
And it may not even be Nehisi. I don't know. I've seen him on TV. But nobody ever says his name that I've heard. And it really means something to me to get people's names right. As well.
But your point is?
But my point is, if we're going to talk about all of that, and we don't wind up talking about what happened in Arizona at Netroots Nation, then I think we've done a bit of a disservice, and you know what I'm talking about, I trust.
Yes, yes.
Now, I've had considerable experience with Netroots Nation. I've been to three of them. Next year it's in St. Louis. Meet me in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Maybe we could finally have that big horn in.
That would be good.
But Netroots Nation got Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley to come and address the progressive faithful there in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
11,000 people turned out to hear Bernie. But along the way, some folks from the Black Lives Matter movement interrupted the proceedings.
Yes.
And I have read and read and read and watched some of the video of it. And I don't know what to think. And I would like to think that this program's a little bit unique in that I'm saying I don't know what to think instead of telling people what to think. Inviting dialogue and discussion instead of delivering marching orders. I know what I know what my gut response is. And that is to side with the Black Lives Matter activists.
Yes.
But there's a lot of people who are on the other side of that. The same people, some of the same people who were hooting about the Confederate flag 2 weeks ago are saying, well, you know, those, and I have to do the David Brooks voice. Well, you know, those people didn't do anything for their cause by interrupting Mr. O'Malley and Mr. Sanders. Like, God damn, really? And I wasn't there, but I'd like to hope I was on the right side of it. But the other side of that coin is that both, and I'm not behind O'Malley the way that I am Sanders. But there's a certain presumption that somehow they're clueless, when in point of fact, either one of them, less so O'Malley because of Baltimore, but certainly Bernie. I mean, Bernie Sanders got arrested in Chicago in 1962 protesting segregation, for Christ's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
Year before I was born. They've got the right issues. And I have to wonder, will the Black Lives Matter folks do the same thing at a Hillary event?
Here was the tragedy of that whole thing, is that I think that people like Bernie Sanders and the protesters probably agree on just about every issue, but I don't think they have a language to talk to each other about it. And as
that seems to be the consensus.
What happens is anger builds, communication breaks down, and it looks like a clusterfuck when it's all done. And I've heard it be described as frustration, as anger, as fat. The irritated because they were there to hear the candidates, and they even got a bit angry, and they were like, you know, these are your allies. Why are you attacking them? Why are you disrupting an event where the very people who are the most sympathetic to your cause, you know, you won't even let talk? And so I think it comes down to some people were pissed because they felt inconvenienced by not being able to hear the people speak that they came to hear speak. But they don't stop to think that...
Wow, does that leave me cold?
Well, yeah, but they're not stopping to think that they were being faced by people who are being slaughtered in the streets and are being unfairly imprisoned. And again, it's this feeling of this hopelessness and this helplessness. I said a year ago that we were going to have another, you know, period where the black community was going to rise up, and I was hoping that it wouldn't get to the point of burning our cities down. Because that's what, you know, Martin Luther King said, what, violence is the language of the voiceless?
Yeah,
or something like that?
The language of the unheard.
Or the language of the unheard. And there is not a demographic in this country that truly is more unheard than the black community. Especially for people who have been here for as many years as they have, who were brought here unwillingly, who have fought so hard for every scrap of everything that they've gotten, and are watching all of this get rolled back.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I like you. There are two sides to this thing, but they said that O'Malley, from what I've read and from what I've heard, O'Malley spent the entire day sitting down with activists, talking, listening. They felt that Bernie kind of missed an opportunity.
Yeah, because Bernie just shut everything down.
Well, I suppose he did miss a golden opportunity to close the gap with people who are trying to connect with his message. But he has been an advocate for the meta issues that really affect these people. And so, yeah, I get this. I get the frustration with the whole thing.
But there is something here that rouses a little bit of suspicion in my paranoid heart, Carol.
And you can.
And it's best. It was best put by Marty, who is a man of color,
mm-hmm.
who just wrote and said the Black Lives Matter people were either interrupting just to be plain rude, or they were plants for Hillary. On either Raw Story or Crooks and Liars, I suggested that they take their message to the Repiglick and Clown Car Parade.
And that's possible. I think that that's an entire.
Well, I think we'll find out if we. Well, one, it's going to be much more difficult to do it with Hillary, because Senator Secretary Clinton is much more cordoned off as a former first lady. I mean, she's got she's got much deeper layers of security. So nobody's going to get up on the stage with her and live to tell the tale.
That's true.
And that's not me going all MENA Airport and Clinton Chronicles. That's Secret Service ain't going to tolerate that shit.
No, they're not.
But I think that will be interesting. And I'm also suspicious because this has there are some roots to this. Again, I go back to that Clinton surrogate, Democratic member of Congress, a Latino man from the Chicago area who said, "Well, I don't." It was interviewed on some stupid program. The political programs. And said, "Well, I don't know if Bernie Sanders even likes Latinos."
Oh, please.
And there's been a running strain of this stuff,
which is what would tend to make people believe that it was very orchestrated by the Clinton campaign, because let's face it, she's got a lot to be worried about.
Steve in New York says maybe they went there to protest Bernie and O'Malley because they were the only ones who would listen. Or maybe they went to Netroots Nation because Netroots Nation bills itself as the meeting, I mean, the meeting of progressives in the United States.
That's right.
And I did see some things along the way. I have not verified them as true, so they may not be. It would be interesting to know, but for reasons of my own, I was willing to believe it, that the Black Lives Matter folks asked Netroots Nation for a panel, one simple panel, and were turned down. And I can believe that in a minute.
I can, too.
Because unless you've got some dough, you ain't getting no panel now. Because it is a very, very, very profit-driven enterprise, even if they've got nonprofit status. Just because you're a nonprofit don't mean you can't make a profit. And there are people with some very, very entrenched jobs there who have to raise a shit ton of money to keep those jobs. It's the same curse that bedevils the entirety of our side of the debate. Mm-hmm. You know, there are so-called social justice organizations out there, or economic justice organizations out there, who have executive directors whose salaries would pay the salaries of 5 19-year-olds in the population group they claim to be worried about.
That's right.
And I don't necessarily know the answer to that question. And poverty sucks.
Poverty sucks.
There is nothing ennobling about it.
No.
There's nothing romantic about walking past them. You remember the opening credits to the Mary Tyler Moore Show many a year ago, Carol?
Sure.
Wow, are we white? there's that scene where she's at the meat case in the grocery store, and she picks up the piece of meat and looks at the price and just rolls her eyes and flips it into the. I think she flips it into her cart. She doesn't throw it back into the meat case. I can't remember
right now. No, I think she flips it into her basket.
Yeah. But you know, hell, I don't even pick it up anymore.
I don't either.
And I'm not crawling up on the cross either.
No, but I remember when I was fresh out of college, I never thought anything about, you know, going and getting whatever I wanted from the grocery store. And now it's like down to meat once a week. Because that's what I can afford.
Yep. Fortunately, rice and beans are nutritious.
I know, but I got to tell you, I almost can't look at rice anymore. I had a couple of months there where that was like my diet, and I can't do it anymore.
Well, I mean, there are limitations on what you can do with it. Although I got to admit, while we were gone, there's this beautiful international market up in Manassas.
Yeah.
Called Global Foods. And it's not all shiny like a Kroger or a Walmart or anything. It's an old grocery store that's been repurposed as a grocery store for the immigrant community in Manassas, which is huge. And they got in their produce section has vegetables you can neither imagine nor pronounce. they have chili peppers there that most people have never heard of. And just mentioning rice, I got all excited about rice because I saw a 10-pound bag of brown basmati rice for $15.
Holy smackers!
And I wanted to bring it home so bad. But, I mean, there's rice and there's rice.
There's rice and there's rice. And it's like the cheap stuff out of the market. That's the stuff that I can't look at anymore. But basmati rice, oh my gosh, it's got this.
And it was sitting next to the 10-pound bag of brown jasmine rice.
Yeah, it's got this wonderful kind of nutty.
And then the jasmine rice actually is perfumey. I mean, it's.
Oh yeah.
But the larger point being that. To turn the conversation back to where we were going with it,
mm-hmm.
it seems like in an attempt to solve problems, we keep identifying problems where and the problem is overshadowed by the fact that we can't talk to each other about them.
Exactly.
And that's why I was talking about things like intersectional dialogue. And it can't be a competition, Carol. You know, I keep coming back to that. One of my favorite lines from any movie ever is spoken by the union organizer in Mate One, who says, "All we got in common is our misery. The least we can do is share it."
Mm-hmm.
And that's the absolute truth.
And I don't know why it is that we can't dialogue. Maybe I'll find out after I read the book. But it seems like that's a real problem that needs to be solved, like, you know, yesterday. Because if we can't seek common ground, then we remain divided, and remaining divided, we just get beat.
I don't know. I guess I'm lucky that I'm not so self-centered that all I can see is myself. I'm not afraid to try and look at something from someone else's perspective, because I'm afraid that I will have to accept the fact that I have white privilege, because it does exist. But I also know that I am able, I find myself able to have very, very frank conversations with people of color. Because I do more listening than talking.
And if anything, that was the saving grace for Martin O'Malley. Because mm-hmm. he did spend the rest of the afternoon listening.
Exactly.
But I got one more question, Carol.
Okay.
And I'm damn, because I've been pondering this all along, based on the fact that Senator Secretary Clinton wasn't at that Netroots Nation gathering mm-hmm. and was not addressed the way that Bernie and Martin O'Malley were. What is it? Do the people in the Black Lives Matter movement think that Hillary Clinton is going to address those issues better or more meaningfully than Sanders or O'Malley?
I'm not sure of that at all. I think she just wasn't there. I think you kind of hit on it. I think they went to the place where they knew that they could be heard.
Because, I have vowed that there will be no Hillary bashing on this program, and I won't do it.
I won't do it either.
But I see nothing in her. I see nothing in her candidacy that suggests that she is more progressive in any way than either Sanders or O'Malley.
I agree.
I think she's probably more progressive than Jim Webb, but Jim Webb's an ex-Republican, and that's a pretty damn low bar to step over. Ain't no jumping involved.
My gripe with Hillary has always been that I just felt that she was too institutionalized to Washington, too much of an insider, too much of a, you know, there's too much money, there's too much. And I never saw her say anything that just made me kind of turn my head and go, wow. And I've never seen a candidate like Bernie Sanders who takes such a populist approach and in a very unafraid way to the issues of the day, speaking to all those things. And no, I don't like everything that he has to say. I thought he totally muffed the whole Israel thing. On the other hand, he's Jewish, so I'm sitting there going, I didn't get to listen to that.
You don't get the perfect candidate.
Yeah, you know. You know, there is no such thing, because if they're all things to all people, then they're no good to anyone.
Well, amen. And having been fooled once and perhaps even fooled twice, I'm trying not to be fooled a third time.
I know. Oh, God, no.
Bill Clinton sounded like the people I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And then turned around and, you know,
The Monica Lewinsky and Whitewater scandals were the best thing that ever happened to Bill Clinton because they rallied the entire nation around him while he systematically took apart. I mean, the beginnings of the end of the FDR Great Society were much more accomplished under Bill Clinton than under Reagan.
That's
a fact.
True. Yes.
And from a broadcast standpoint. Thanks very much for the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And then we start ticking off so-called welfare reform, which was just an act, just an exercise in goddamn brutality, Carol.
It was.
And Glass-Steagall, which was another act of exercise in brutality on a different subset of America. It was a wealth transfer.
Of course.
And the chickens came home to roost in 2007, 2008.
That's right.
And to a certain extent, in the collapse of the dot-com bubble.
Mm-hmm.
There's act after act after act. Jesus, there's the miserable, silly, stupid charade of don't ask, don't tell.
Yes. And here we go all these years later where he says, you know, I wish I had never done these things. Well, thanks, Bill, but
you did.
And
goddamn, you know, marriage equality.
Yeah.
Well, America just wasn't ready for it. Oh, please. But again, that was accomplished by the grassroots.
That was.
And the single most effective grassroots organizing that this country has seen has been the gay community.
Yes.
They said, we're here, we're queer, get over it, and stayed in the country's face.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, it's been delightful to watch the right wing lose their minds.
True.
They didn't have much to lose in the first place, but it makes Mondays and Wednesdays kind of interesting here, doesn't it?
Wednesdays are my favorites.
I know. So,
after all, I sat yesterday through 15 minutes of science, scripture and salvation on some hillbilly radio station.
Oh, sweet Jesus. You took one for the team, did you?
It was alternately frustrating and amusing. The sad part was knowing that there were so many, you know, people sitting there listening to that going, yeah, that's right. It's like a puzzle. Yeah, evolution's like a puzzle. That's what it is. And there's just pieces missing. And so they just make it up. And it's like, no.
And I noticed, I saw that post on Facebook, and I thought, and I realized that you had come to the same place I had. It's one thing to look at these, to hear these people. It is another, and you can, and this is across the board. It's Bill O'Reilly. It's Alex Jones, it's Hannity, Limbaugh, whomever.
Privileged white guys.
Well, A, that, but B, I'm not nearly so scared of them as I am of the fact that at any given moment there are tens of thousands of people taking their goddamn marching orders from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what scares me, the same way with you sitting there listening to Pastor Wackadoodle pontificating away. It's the people who are listening, and that's why, you know, so often when we play clips around, when I play clips around here, it's not what's being said, it's the gomers in the audience who are clapping like wild for the stupidity that gives me the fan tods.
Exactly, because they're sitting there going, see, I knew my scripture was right.
God said it, I believe it, that settles it.
And he proved it, because I was doubting there for a while. But that was just Satan.
Yeah.
Yeah, they said that too. But
I don't know what it was.
I was in like this. It was like I could not get anything on the radio.
Were you on the AM or the FM band?
I was on the FM band.
Oh, God.
I was just
were
in
you,
a...
Were you down in the low double digits or were you up in the triples?
I don't know. I think I was in the low double digits.
Yeah, because see what happened there. Is all the remember when everybody was all hot about community radio?
Mm-hmm.
and how we were going to, it was going to be the antidote to the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and the consolidation of media ownership.
Yeah.
Well, what happened is the Christers got up all the licenses. And so that's why I can be on I-66 coming out of D.C. listening to a goob from Oklahoma. And it's entertaining. I'll give you that. It's if you've got a mind for it and you can just not start screaming, it's entertaining as hell. But then you come back to reality and go, oh, shit.
People yeah, for me, it's entertaining, but it was like, it's ICR Radio, the Institute for Creation Research, and it's all Bible-based. So they're not denying science. They're just rewriting it.
In a Christ-centered fashion.
That's right. And you can hear their that you can pull up their broadcasts online. I'll have to say.
And they never have a problem paying the bills.
No, they don't, I'm sorry to say. Because, trust me, I think they asked for money about 27 times.
Well, I feel a little better about myself.
Yeah, you should. You should. But, yeah, I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
Well, it has been a delightful conversation, Carol.
You too, my friend. Yeah. I wanted you to know you weren't going crazy for no reason. I read that thing, and I'm sitting there shaking my head going, you know, you're speaking to a constituency, Mr. Brooks, of what, 12 people? You know, there's millions of us out here who don't fit your demographic that...
And again, the same principle applies to them. The one percenter out there, especially, and the 1% who vote Republican primarily, are out there reading David Brooks and saying, well, my goodness gracious, he certainly has this, he certainly has pegged this Negro. Muffy, bring me a lobster thermidor. Don't do it yourself, dear. Have the help bring me another lobster thermidor.
Consuelo.
By the way, Ron in Canada, upon the fundraising mention,
yeah.
Ron said, yeah, Bob, you're a cheap date. Well, I resemble that remark.
The cheap dates were the most fun ones, though.
Amen. Absolutely.
Well, you have a good night, Bob.
I'm going to try.
Go talk to our other friends.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Later.
Bye.
Our buddy Carol out in Hooterville. Haley says, Bob, we have the Pick 5, 5 for $20 meat section in our store. Is it a wiggling pig, Haley? Mine's a wiggling pig. It's a mix of fresh meat, beef, pork, chicken, and processed and smoked meats. Snap customers make up a large percentage of the customer base, especially those that are unable to drive a half hour to towns north and south of here. This is the only grocery store in a town of 2,500 plus. Meanwhile, there are at least 20 churches and 3 banks. No liquor stores because of being a dry county. Can you get beer? Wine? Is it that kind of dry county, or is it a dry county like I grew up in? And believe me, we peruse the 5 for 20 section intensely. That and the manager's special day over at Kroger are my favorite. If you understand a little bit about the expiration date business, you know, you can occasionally do okay. Jack in Shreveport points out, by the way, no eating out of dumpsters either, at least from McDonald's. Oh, God. And I guess we'll have to wait till after the program ends to figure out just what in the hell's going on with the chat room. That'll be a blast. So it is 9 minutes past the hour. We got 51 minutes remaining in the program. Plenty of time for your conversation if you want to get involved, participate, offer your thoughts. I really do. Just, you know, philosophically, I like for us to be driven in this program by discussion and inquiry. Because I guess I'm kind of a contrary, but I don't like being told what to think. And I guess that's why right-wing radio never spoke to me. And I guess that's why people like David Brooks get under my skin. Because he tries to speak so authoritarianly, as if he alone is in possession of the answers. But I'm going to find out what it was that got him so daggum worked up. Thank you very kindly to Thomas Jug a Punch. He just sent me Mr. Coates' book. And if anybody wants to send me a pronouncer, I would welcome it. And I know that just makes me sound so ignorantly white, it's not funny. And it isn't funny. But I try not to butcher people's names. But I'm gonna find out what it was that got David Brooks' maiden forms in a bunch. And yeah, we've got $100 in challenges on the table that can be doubled. The next $100 gets doubled to two if you will but respond. And you don't have to send in 100. You don't have to send in 50 or even 20 or 10. 5 is fine. Because this is a community effort. And that effort includes making the horn available for anyone who wants it. A lot of people out there who can't afford it, but for whom this program means a very great deal. And so, that's what happens. That's how we keep this all on the air. At some point in time, we'll talk about maybe a little equipment project, but not right now. It would be, I'm not going to go there. Because, among other things, we have ever so many more ends to get after. In the next 48 minutes or so. But we're going to take a little break. And if you want to jump into the conversation, you're welcome to. You know the numbers, 304-574-8178 or 304-663-HORN, 663-4676. Either way is fine. And then, of course, Skype to Skype is Bob Kincaid Horn, and you're welcome any way you see fit to chime in. This is listener-supported conversation radio. Whether you, if you want to use the U.S. Postal Service, just drop me a note and tell me so I can count it in the challenge. Or, you know, PayPal. Either way is fine. The most important thing is that we not leave challenges on the table. We'll be back. I'm Bob.
Thank you.
It's a long-distance dedication going out to you, David Brooks. Yes, indeed. Eric Clapton and White Room. I'm so proud of myself on little moments like that. 19 minutes past the hour on this Moran Monday, which has somehow or another managed to fly by. And it wouldn't be Moran Monday if we didn't celebrate some just plain, unvarnished, outright, 200-proof, garden-variety stupid. And, of course, in order to do that, we have to go over to Fox News TV Radio Rwanda. This is delightful. The home of stupid. I mean, there's mean and hateful and spiteful and wrong and propagandistic. But the home of stupid on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda is that morning program with Kilmeade and Ducey Elizabeth. It was a lot more fun talking about Elizabeth back when Juanita would call in with her View report. But there's something. If you're paying attention, there are these little moments when you realize that we really are in a transitional phase relative to media, and that the traditional media are freaking lost for how to deal with it. There was a brilliant example of it this morning. Over the weekend, a video went viral of a surfing contest off the coast of South Africa, in which a great white shark attacked a surfer. And I think everybody in the world had seen, well, it certainly feels that way, had seen that video. Ferg looked at it and went, "Oh, cool, Dad, look, he's beating the shit out of that shark." And, I mean, it says a lot, and this is a world-class surfer. And he was. He was attacked by the shark, and he beat the shark. And then they snatched him out of the water. He would not have gone more than one round. No. But this morning, all the for-profit media morning programs, it seemed, were running the video. Oh, that's her. Elizabeth Hasselbeck. Thank you, Carol. But in running that video, it kind of showed how clueless the for-profit media are. It's as if they don't know that, I mean, but they even acknowledged that it had gone viral. So they're showing something to people who have already seen it. And then somehow, I guess, trying to make it a value-added product by talking about it more or less intelligently. And since we're talking about Fox News TV Radio Rwanda, we're talking about the less side of the equation. Enter Brian Kilmeade. Well, it's a short clip. Let's just enjoy the whole thing, shall we?
Take a look at this. It's the video everyone is talking about, a surfer in South Africa.
See what I mean? They already know everybody's talking about it, which sort of evades the issue of everybody's already seen it. There's no editorial anything with these programs anymore. Okay. So even Elizabeth Hasselbeck knows that everybody's already seen it. But that's not going to slow them down.
Attacked by a shark on live television.
Last season, as you look at Fanning on the rankings, you can see it.
This is the audio of the...
Holy excuse me.
Yeah, now this was a live broadcast, presumably in South Africa, and the broadcaster, the guy doing the... Do they have play-by-play in surf competitions? Don't know. But he goes, holy shit, But of course, here in America, no one's ever heard that word. So the funky communication commissions has to make sure that nobody hears it, because then American people might start using the word shit all over the place. And I mean, he said holy shit, so he was being blasphemous as well. Doesn't this just show how silly, how parochial, how puritanical our broadcast standards are? That was an honest statement, an emotional statement, an emotional outburst, if you will. But by God, we can't have anybody saying the funky communications commission will not have anybody saying the brown word on gut standing, God fearing, Bible believing, Christ centered television on the. Because, you know, John Hagee might tell the commissioner of the FCC to starve or something, right? Anyway, so they're running the video and the audio of the shark attack. Not exactly compelling.
So scary. Radio. Surfing champion Mick Fanning fighting off a huge shark during a competition after dragged him under the water for what seemed like, I'm sure, an eternity. Crews racing over to pull Fanning out of the water. You see that here. And amazingly, he emerged without a scratch.
Yeah, he said, I was waiting for the teeth to come at me. I punched him in the back. He also used his surfboard as a shield at one point, and apparently one of the problems was the shark actually got tangled up in his leg leash.
Yeah.
That was attached to him and the board, and the shark was between it.
One thing, I give these jet skis a lot of credit, too. They were the first ones out there going through the waves, over the waves, to try to get to him as quick as possible. And
now, that's Steve Ducey talking. Now, the first guy was Brian Kilmeade, and we're waiting for the real moment of Moran Monday genius from him.
And can you imagine being a surfer right next to him and hearing the announcer go, everybody out of the water, look out, there's a shark. And next thing you know, it's him. I think the most shocking thing is, after you hear about the six attacks in North Carolina, okay, these are just swimmers. But then when you see a champion surfer and you have a three-camera shooting an overhead shot, say, oh my goodness, it could happen anywhere. You would...
Professional broadcasting. It could happen anywhere. It could happen in the middle of the desert. Well, I mean, there aren't any sharks there, but... well, I mean, anywhere in the water, maybe. I mean, North Carolina, South Africa, it's almost as if sharks are in the water, as if all the waters of the planet are interconnected, and North Carolina and South Africa are on the same planet! Woo! But even that is not the acme of moranity. No. I mean, you've got a three-camera shot here, and jet skis. You can almost hear these dumbasses salivating to be able to watch somebody off of it. I mean, it cost a lot to send a Fox News team to South Africa to watch somebody get eaten by a shark, but... I mean, maybe we could get a three-camera team down to the Outer Banks, and we could watch somebody get eaten by a shark. Wouldn't that be awesome? I mean, our viewership share in the morning drive slot would be huge if we had an exclusive of somebody getting eaten by a shark. We'll try to get a team down there. Can the graphics department get on the shark attack graphics and? Can we get somebody in the music department to, I guess we can't, you know, something along those lines.
Okay, these are just swimmers, but then when you see a champion surfer and you have a three-camera shooting an overhead...
These are just swimmers. But if there was a three-camera shot, well, then it would be something. I mean, they're just swimmers. They're not somebody's wife, it's not somebody's husband, it's not... It's not somebody's
mother or father or cousin or aunt or uncle or neighbor or friend. These are just swimmers. Oh, but if they got eaten by a shark!
I don't know. I think we're... Yeah. Yeah. We need some philosophy here.
You dick!
Thank you. Thank you.
Headshot. Say, oh my goodness, it could happen anywhere. You would think that they'd have a way of clearing the waters for a competition at this level, but I guess they don't.
Oh, you got that? You would think they would have a way of clearing the waters of these sharks for a competition, but I guess they don't. Yep, I'm the last dodo. And what would that way be? Round them up and give them all bus tickets to another city like we do with the homeless whenever a political convention comes to town? One way, mind you. Maybe chum the water with little North Carolina children all the way back across the Atlantic so that they can have their surfing tournament? Maybe get the Australians to use their secret underwater great white shark whistles? He guesses they don't. And meanwhile, like Carol and I were talking about, Emery and Marveline are sitting there in the matching Barca loungers.
Marveline, I never had any idea at all they couldn't clear the water of the sharks. Did you know that, Marveline? Shut up, Emery. Take your Aricept. Mother.
Headshot, say, oh my goodness, it could happen anywhere. You would think that they'd have a way of clearing the waters for a competition at this level, but I guess they don't.
And by the way, the font is Jawsome Dude. Surfer fights off shark on live television. Tell me, is the next program after the morning program on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda, is that my balls, or is that Monday morning rehabilitation?
I'm world surfing champion isn't safe. Who is? You asked, right?
What? No. Okay. So there was that. Can't leave that out. Elizabeth Hasselbeck had some wisdom to add.
Of clearing the waters for a competition at this level, but I guess they don't.
If a three-time world surfing champion isn't safe, who is? Yeah.
You got that right. Oh, God. I forgot to issue the duct tape and the hockey puck warning. If a three-time world champion surfer isn't safe, who is?
Well, I don't know, Elizabeth. How was he dressed?
Three times.
It's the same shark.
Okay, I'm taking a little grief from Brother Deacon Asa. Can kill me and douchey? You're reaching for the low-hanging fruit now, aren't you, Bob?
No, this is the heart and soul of Moran Monday. This is
this is the kernel. This is the grain of sand around which the Moran pearl forms. Probably, damn oyster probably got eaten by a shark. These professional broadcast fools have all the self-awareness of a sea monkey. It's just precious.
Way of clearing the waters for a competition at this level, but I guess they don't.
If a three-time world surfing champion isn't safe, who is? You ask right there. They did cancel the rest of the competition, saying surfer safety are our priority.
When he goes down, I'm thinking he's hit. I guess he was technically hit.
Well, he was caught between the board and the shark, and because he was attached to the board and the shark went down, he went down with it, and then there's a big wave right there. We don't see him for about 5 seconds. Some people jumped the shark. He actually punched one to make sure he was alive.
The question is, does he get back on? Does he go back out there? Or does he do something else? Does he go to a department store and start going into sales?
He's going to get back on the surfboard.
You think so?
Yeah.
I think so.
Let's find out.
And the shark should be afraid of him. That was a tough punch he gave him there.
Right.
Uh-oh. I think so. Well, it was a tough punch he gave him there. The shark should be afraid of him. No. Damn it. That's a right-wing jackass. There's a bunch of jokes about him. Walker, Texas Ranger. Shark should be afraid. He is the most, or I don't know, maybe it's a beer commercial. Sharks attack him and find themselves too interested in his conversation to bite. He is the most interesting surfer in the world. Stay sharky, my friend. Chuck Norris. That was a Chuck Norris joke. But, of course, there's also, and not that these geniuses would have any interest or ability to analyze the deeper meanings behind lots of sharks wandering around the shores or anything like that. No, hell no! But there are questions of, you know, what, I mean, you might ask a marine biologist. I mean, that might have been useful. But then again, it was happening on Fox, so useful is kind of out the window. We're just trying to terrify the octogenarians. Yeah, Marvelina, I don't know how I feel about getting in the whirlpool anymore. But there are marine and ecological reasons for why sharks. I mean, they're not just random animals. They behave according to instinct and feeding patterns and breeding patterns and whatnot. And isn't the Cape off of South Africa isn't that known for being a kind of a sharky area? Kind of like outside the Great Barrier Reef? Or off Martha's Vineyard? Or like in the ocean where sharks live? You were right, Marty. It is. It is always a bumper crop on Mondays around here. Since we were talking to Carol, I was just a little bit ago. How about she's of course in Hooterville. How about a trip up to Missouri, Stan? And the ironically named because she never takes not even a second off, Christian County, Missouri. Joey Kyle is the former sheriff of Christian County, Missouri. According to the Springfield News Leader, he pleaded guilty this past May to embezzlement and aiding a fraud scheme. And I'm surprised his lawyer didn't try to plead insanity. But then again, if it didn't work in Aurora, Colorado, it ain't going to work in a case like this. Sheriff Dwight McNeil, who has taken over for Joey Kyle, the former sheriff of Christian County, and now guilty pleading embezzlement and aiding a fraud scheme committer. It was January 2014 when Christian County let Sheriff Kyle go off to a U.S. Chamber of Commerce conference in Las Vegas. But what happened in Vegas didn't stay in Vegas. And I don't know how it is you get clued in to something like this at a Chamber of Commerce conference, but it happened. He came back, Sheriff Joey Kyle did. He came back from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce meeting in Vegas absolutely on zealous fire for the end times. No, really. And because he was all, according to Lou LaPaglia, who was the presiding commissioner there from 2011 to 2014, he was all jacked up or hyped up about what he learned or heard there. Sheriff Dwight McNeil said he bought all this stuff, and it was apparently purchased as part of an end-time plan, part of a survival plan, because he stockpiled 3 tons of food in the basement of the Christian County, Missouri jail. Because he was prepping for the apocalypse. Among other things, Sheriff Joey Kyle was all worried about Israel attacking its neighbors, and then the U.S. would invade Iran. And he said, and then Sheriff Joey Kyle, being a law enforcement professional, said that'd trigger your major war and hasten the biblically foretold battle of Armageddon, which, interestingly, ain't in Missouri, no matter what the Mormons tell you. Now, you do know that the Mormons believed that the Garden of Eden was in Missouri, right? It was on the plates. You know, the plates that got dug up in New York that were written in Reformed Egyptian, a language that never existed. Boop. Yeah. Dwight McNeil is the interim sheriff, and he said, as a taxpayer, I was appalled at what we found there. To wit, the 3 tons of food in the jail basement. Wonder if he bought them from Glenn Beck. Wouldn't that be delightful? But it wasn't just the food. He was ready for the zombie apocalypse, too. He had an armory including C4 explosives, blasting caps, an Iraqi-made grenade launcher. And he kept it all in a closet directly underneath the county courtroom. The folks reporting this story say it's not clear whether Sheriff Kyle bought the stockpiled food, which was donated to the Christian County Family Crisis Center, with taxpayer funds. But I think that question got answered by the guilty plea, didn't it? Or was that for the purchase of the Iraqi grenade launcher? It's one of those nights. It's one of those nights. It's like seeing a cockroach when you flip the light on in the kitchen at 2 o'clock in the morning. If you see one,
You got 1,000. There's one county sheriff in Christian County, Missouri, who was stockpiling food and just waiting for the Armageddon. I'm guessing there's probably more than one. And again, there's probably a million or more Americans out there stockpiling food and guns and, oh dear God, just waiting for Jesus to come back in his holy rolls. Some of them think it'll be the General Lee. Oh, God Almighty. This country is a lot more interesting than a lot of people know. You see, every day out on the street, people were passing Sheriff Kyle. Morning, Sheriff Kyle. Morning, ma'am. Lovely day here in Christian County, Missouri, ain't it, Sheriff Kyle? It certainly is, ma'am. Are you prepared for the coming apocalypse? Huh? When our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ comes back and the tribulation is unleashed because the U.S. is going to attack Iran after Israel attacks its neighbors. Are you ready? Are you ready to meet the Lord? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, over in Florida, Stan, they're in Duval County. Is that Jacksonville? Is Duval County Jacksonville? I always get it confused because there's a Duval Street in Key West, but Key West is Monroe County. I think Duval County is Jacksonville. But there's a little elementary school, ironically named New Berlin Elementary School, where some parents want to do some book banning. I told you, she never even takes her eye off for a second. Now, these are, of course, good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, fun, evangelical, fundamentalist parents. And the books they want to ban are books for little children. I'll give you a hint. The books are the title of the books are Nasreen's Secret School and The Librarian of Basra. Mm-hmm. Does that give you a clue? Yeah. But here's what's even funnier. The parents want to ban the books because the children, the fictional children depicted in the books, which was written by a Merkin woman, no less, not some heathen. Jeanette Winter wrote the books. And she wrote them to introduce children to the idea that maybe childhood isn't the same all over the world. Because, for instance, Nasreen's Secret School is about a little girl named Nasreen whose daddy gets taken away in the dark and still of the night by the Taliban because she lives in Afghanistan. So her grandma and her mama take her to a secret school where little Nasreen, even though a female, can still keep learning to read and write. And as they take her to the secret school, Nasreen's grandmother prays, "Please, Allah, open her eyes to the world." Well, Nasreen's grandma praying to that Allah, well, that didn't work for the parents there of the little children at New Berlin Elementary School. Mm-hmm. Diane Haynes Roberts is a grandma herself.
She's a grandma of a number of little students there at New Berlin Elementary School. No word on whether they wear brown shirts at New Berlin Elementary School. But Grandma Diane said, "We're talking about third graders, and they're very impressionable. I don't think they need to know the horrors of the world. Now, I'm a Christian, and in public school, we're not allowed to have any references to God or Jesus or passages about creation. I just think what's good for one group should be good for all." Now, of course, because she is dumber than a bag of hammers, Diane Haynes Roberts, Grandma, is wrong. There's no ban on the mention of God. There's no ban on the mention of Jesus. And creation stories are completely legal to share as long as they are understood to be, and I'm not real thrilled about this, comparative religion. But if this woman is a Christian, as she says she is, one has to wonder, are they not teaching her precious grandbabies? Are they not teaching them about creation and God and Jesus in Sunday school? What Sunday school is she taking them to? So there you have it. A bunch of dead from the neck up, evangelical, fundamentalist Christians want to ban a book about people living in a different part of the world where evangelical, fundamentalist Muslims ban books. I told you, she never takes her eye off the ball, the goddess of irony. Never. The suspiciously named school superintendent, Nikolai Vidi, is on record as saying that he thinks probably not the best idea in the world to be banning books. We're walking up a slippery slope when we start to decide what books we're going to ban from the curriculum. There are some intelligent people, intelligent parents of little intelligent children at New Berlin Elementary School. Devin Mears is one of them, a mother of one of the third graders, said, "I question if they even read the books." Probably didn't. They didn't need to. Jesus told them it was evil. Because it mentions that Oller fella. All right, we got 8 minutes to go in the program, and it looks like, and thank you, Thomas, for jumping in there. It looks like we are going to wind up, Thomas made me do math. We've got, as regarding the challenge, we have $86.84 to go. Luda, you started something. Make Bob do the challenge, make Bob do the contribution math on the fly. Very funny. But, yeah, $86.84 to go. Thank you, Thomas. And thank you kindly for the book. And thank you to, thank you very kindly to Joan and to Randy for getting part of the challenges taken care of. Thank you to Tom and our anonymous challenger, and of course to Robert in Australia for his 20th of the month Up Over Down Under challenge. Tom for the Have Half a Show on Me challenge. Thank you very kindly. Okay, let's run over and talk to Jim for a minute. Hey, Jim.
How you doing?
I'm okay.
Well, this doesn't have much to say about what you were talking about, but you mentioned Berlin, and I was thinking today is the anniversary of the Attentat, the effort to blow Hitler to hell, but it didn't work. And
this is that day?
This is that day when Von Stauffenberg and his aide planted that briefcase beneath his table. Why in the hell they didn't put two things of explosives in that briefcase? Because, you know...
Well, that was a sturdy-ass table, too, wasn't it?
It was. It was. Too sturdy. And, ironically enough, more people died between that date and May 8th than had died in the previous 4 years of the war.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes, sir. So, I mean, they were well-intentioned people, but I guess if you have just the use of one hand, as von Stauffenberg did, and Hitler's adjutant Brandt moved the thing over behind the stand of the table. It was a big, thick table. Hitler was able to meet Mussolini that afternoon and proclaimed that he had been spared by Providence to continue his work upon the world.
Oh, dear God. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost, right?
Yeah, I mean, they had two bricks of explosives, and hell, the second one they threw out on the side of the road, leaving the wolf lair, and the Gestapo found it. But if he had just left that briefcase where it was, or if they had used the two bricks of explosives, that war would have come to perhaps a different conclusion.
Because that was the purpose. I mean, they everybody else recognized the war was lost.
Oh, yeah, except Hitler and his paladins, who didn't want it to be lost because they knew exactly what was in store for them. And of course, a lot of people suffered under the People's Court. Ironically enough, the guy who was conducting the People's Court trial, Roland Freisler, who was also attendee at the Wannsee Conference, well, he didn't quite finish his little judge duty with them, because during one of the trials, there was an air raid, and he got bunked in the head by a big beam and was killed. So I guess there is an element of justice to a certain extent. But, you know, it's an honor of both men who that evening were shocked when they realized that the thing had failed and Hitler was making his broadcast that he was fine. And only got, well, some singed hair and some burned trousers. And, you know, he just thought that was the signal for him that the tide had turned.
God Almighty.
Well, there were people of good intentions who... Unfortunately, the road to hell is paved with such, but at least...
Yeah, and leftover bricks of explosives, too, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't understand why, I guess, because I think von Stauffenberg was in some anteroom changing his shirt, and, of course, the briefing had been called up an hour early because Mussolini was arriving by the train. And the fact that it was so hot... They couldn't hold that briefing in the original bunker, which would have contained the explosion and blown them all to smithereens. See, the bunker that, you know, that they usually use for that, Hitler had poured, I don't know how much more concrete on top of it. Concrete wasn't dry, and because of that, the temperature of the interior bunker was 130 degrees. Because it's pretty hot over there in East Prussia in July. So they held it in the lager bunker, which was just wooden and would not contain the explosion. But, I mean, it's just one of those things in history that I think we need to remember.
We do, and I didn't realize this was the date. I thank you, Jim. We got to get out of here, though. Right at that time.
Well, you take it easy. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Bye now. I really didn't. I didn't know this was that anniversary. A note from Robert in Australia regarding sharks. Humans land, sharks water. Go into their domain looking like dinner and expect a shark to have a taste. I just wish commentators who don't have a clue about what they're talking about would stop making comments like, you'd think they'd have ways to, who are they, and how much would you like them to spend on developing a method to keep sharks away from surf competitions
before you object to the cost. Well, the conservatives we have always with you. We net beaches, or we used to, I'll have to check, here in Australia, and they kill more dolphins than sharks. Honestly, more people die on the roads and no one blinks an eye. Yeah, but they're not eaten on the road by sharks. We have a lot more hillbillies poisoned by mountaintop removal than are eaten by, you know, bobcats or bears. But, well, you get the idea. Time to get out of here. Thank you very kindly for all of for your kind attention this Moran Monday. Back tomorrow with Titanic Tuesday. Right? Yep. And, again, thanks, everybody. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.